Welcome to the Biblical Languages Podcast, brought to you by Biblingo. We bring together the latest research in linguistics, language acquisition, and biblical studies to better understand the biblical languages and ultimately the biblical text. As always, this episode is brought to you by Biblingo, the premier solution for learning, maintaining, and enjoying the biblical languages. Visit biblingo.org to learn more and start your 10-day free trial.
Welcome to the Biblical Languages Podcast. I'm Kevin Grosso, and I am going to discuss the grammar of Good Friday and Easter today. So what we're going to do is look at a few key sayings of Jesus during his crucifixion, or just before, and after his resurrection. So I'm going to try to make this as accessible as possible to everyone. That being said, we're going to look pretty deeply at times into the Greek and Hebrew to try to figure out what Jesus was saying in some of these key moments. So I am going to try to explain all the technical terms I use and things like that, because I know this could be of interest to lots of different people. So bear with me. If you are a scholar and you feel like I'm going too slow, I'm sorry. If you are a layperson and don't know any Greek and Hebrew, I'm going to do my best to translate everything and make this accessible, but bear with me as well. If it is a little bit too fast, you can go back and listen to it as well. If you are listening to this, I do have slides. So you are welcome to look at the slides on YouTube. But again, I'm going to try to make it accessible to listeners only so that you don't necessarily need the slides, though, especially if you do know some Greek or Hebrew, it might be helpful to see these texts. Without further ado, let's get into it. We're going to discuss four different sayings of Jesus, and we're going to actually start in Isaiah 53, where it discusses God's servant not opening his mouth. Okay, so that's going to be our starting point outside of the Gospels, obviously. And then we're going to move to Jesus before Caiaphas, and then we're going to go to the cry of dereliction, which is represented variously in Matthew and Mark. That's, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" So we're going to look at that. And then we're going to look at Jesus's conversation with Peter after the resurrection, where he says, "Peter, do you love me?" And then we're going to wrap it up with some conclusions from this. Okay, so that's where we're going. So to begin with, Isaiah 53, particularly Isaiah 53:7. So this chapter really is actually quite difficult in Hebrew. There are a lot of things in here that are very tricky from a grammatical standpoint. We're going to look at just one of these things in Isaiah 53 verse 7. I have pulled up here three different translations: NIV, NLT, ESV, so New International Version, New Living Translation, and the English Standard Version. These are very popular translations, and they also represent a spectrum of translation philosophies, which is something that we've talked about on our podcast. You can go check out our series on translation philosophy and how to translate the New Testament. So the ESV is going to be more word for word, or even morpheme for morpheme. So what that means is basically they're going to take one Greek or Hebrew unit of meaning and they're going to try to replace it with one in English. Okay. The NLT is going to be more focused on, let's try to figure out the meaning of the text and then put that into English, maybe in a way that's different than one-to-one correspondence between word to word. And the NIV is somewhere in the middle. So all the translations, though, agree. So here are three different translations with three different philosophies on how to translate. And they all agree, though, about this one line. I've highlighted in red, again, for those who are just listening, I'll just read it. "He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth." This is the phrase we're going to look at. So this is the NIV here. "He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth." The NLT, similar. "He was oppressed and treated harshly, yet he never said a word." Okay, so here the NLT is being a little bit more creative with how they're saying it. "Never said a word," right? And that, again, reflects their translation philosophy. I'm not going to say anything good or bad about their philosophy. I'm just saying it's different. "He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep is silent before the shearers, he did not open his mouth." Okay. So again, that same phrase, "he did not open his mouth." The NLT, the first time, translates, "he never said a word." And the second time, "he did not open his mouth." The ESV is very similar to the NIV. "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth." like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth. So from this, the question is, especially if you know Hebrew, what should we expect the Hebrew to be? So there are three different verb forms in Hebrew that can be negated. Okay, the three are yiktol, katal, and kotel, or the participle. So again, you don't need to know any of this. If you don't know all the terms, that's okay. I'm just going to explain what this means, okay? If you just looked at the English translations, you would expect he did not open his mouth to be a katal form, right? Because katal normally refers to things that are in the past or things that have been done. So in English, we will often translate this with he has opened his mouth, something like that, in the positive form, or he opened his mouth. Okay, those are the two most common translations of the katal form into English. So here we have that translation, right? But in the Hebrew, we actually don't have that form. We have the yiktol form. So again, the yiktol form is most of the time, about 80% of the time, it's translated from Hebrew into English with a future tense form. So here we have, in Hebrew, it says, velo yiftach piv, which is, again, if you were just taking an out-of-the-blue context, the normal translation you would have is he will not open his mouth, okay? But none of our translations go for that, right? None of them say he will not open his mouth. They all make this, he did not open his mouth in the past tense, just normal, he didn't do this thing. So how should we understand this difference, right? I mean, in Hebrew, it's different. And what's actually interesting is that there is a manuscript in Qumran that has patach, so that's the katal form in this context. And they also are seeing, okay, this is a past tense context. And so there is a manuscript of Isaiah with velo patach piv. And so maybe that is justification for the English translations as well to just follow the Dead Sea Scroll evidence here and say, okay, maybe that's actually the correct written form. I'm going to suggest a different interpretation that does justice to the yiktol form, but is not just plain old past, okay? And that is what is called a modal interpretation. And in English, we have these modal verb forms, should, might, can, would, right? All of these are English modals, and they have different meanings, right? If I said, I should open my mouth, that means one thing. I can open my mouth means another thing, et cetera, et cetera. So the yiktol form, it is normally translated with future, will. But actually, even in English, will, could be argued, is a modal. It's a modal verb. So it is very similar to can, right? I can open my mouth. I will open my mouth. It occupies a very similar spot in the syntax. So the question is there another? So will doesn't work here. And translations have recognized that. But is there another kind of modal verb or idea that might fit this context? And in fact, the yiktol form is used in past tense context with these modal ideas. So there's an example in Exodus with he could not gather something. And that's this yiktol form in the past tense context with the negator. Okay, so I'm going to suggest, so if we go back to our translations, he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he would not open his mouth, is actually the better understanding here. So this is not just reporting what this person did, right? It's suggesting, so when I say that he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he would not open his mouth, it suggests that there's something that is compelling him to open his mouth, but he doesn't do it. That's the idea here. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he would not open his mouth, and he would not open his mouth. So the idea is that there is reason to open your mouth, right? Actually, if you are being led like a lamb to the slaughter, then you should open your mouth. But despite this, he doesn't. And this is, again, the point here is that you actually lose that in the translations that have been provided in the NIV, NLT, and ESV. You lose this flavor of there's something that is compelling him to open his mouth, and he doesn't, even despite reason to. So that is, I suggest, the proper way to understand Isaiah 53:7. And that brings us to Jesus before Caiaphas, where we begin with this line, but Jesus was silent. And so again, this is probably echoing Isaiah 53:7. So this is in Matthew 26:63 and in Mark 14:61. In Greek, it says, Hode Iesus Esiopa. And so that is, but Jesus was silent. And it says the same thing in Mark 14:61. So we have this same kind of context here, right? Where there is something that's compelling Jesus to speak out for himself, but he doesn't, right? And so he would not open his mouth, even though he had reason to, namely being on trial and facing death. So then we come to Caiaphas' question. It says, I'll read it in Greek. I'll just read the relevant part here, just for the sake of time. Tell us, you know, Esu e ho Christos ho Quios tu theou. So this is just read from Matthew's version. Tell us if you are Esu e ho Christos, if you are the Christ, ho Quios tu theou, the Son of God. Okay. Again, Mark's version is very similar. They ask him if he is. They ask him, Su e ho Christos ho Quios tu ologe tu. This is very similar. Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? So in Matthew's version, we have the Son of God, and in Mark's version, we have the Son of the Blessed. And that's probably just a circumlocution for God's name in the mouth of Caiaphas. So Caiaphas doesn't want to say God. He says blessed, and that's a reference to God. Okay, so pretty much the same thing. Luke's version omits the son of clause or the son of phrase. And so it just says, you know, Esu eho Christos. They ask him whether he is the Christ. So this is the question. What is very interesting is that Caiaphas here is equating Christos, the Christ, with Son of God. Okay, so that's going to play a role in Jesus' answer. That's going to be interesting when we look at Jesus' answer. But this also suggests a certain meaning for the phrase Son of God, right? It seems like Caiaphas is making Christ and Son of God equivalent. Now, there's all kinds of debate about this that I don't want to get into, but just to point out that in this case, at least, it might not be that Son of God means ontologically God's son in the same way that other texts might mean Son of God. Again, I'm not saying that Son of God always means Christ or vice versa, right? But in this case, with Caiaphas, he seems to be equating Christ and Son of God. And then Jesus gives this reply, and he quotes Daniel 7, and he calls himself the Son of Man. And immediately, so now we're moving to the reply here, immediately Caiaphas tears his clothes and says this is blasphemy. So he actually, Jesus, doesn't call himself. He's asked whether he is the Christ, the Son of God. And then he says, oh, I'm actually the Son of Man, which seems to suggest that the Son of Man here is a title that Jesus is using that would place himself even maybe even above the Christ or the Son of God in Caiaphas's mind, at the very least equivalent to. So let's look more deeply at Jesus' response. So in Matthew 26:64, Jesus responds, Su epas. So this is translated normally, you have said so, or you have said, okay? It's a weird answer to the question because it doesn't answer the question. At least in our minds, it doesn't. Yes, Jesus, Caiaphas has indeed said the thing that he just said. Now, why are you saying that he said that? So it's interesting because in none of the versions, actually, does Jesus ever say nai, the Greek word for yes. Now, the question is, what does Caiaphas understand when Jesus says su epas, or you have said so, in Matthew's version, at least? In biblical Hebrew, there is no word for yes. The way you would answer a question is you would repeat part of the question. So if I said, are you hungry? The response would be, I am. Are you hungry? I am. And that's just how you affirmed a yes, no question. So there was no word for yes. That seems to be what's going on here. Su epas, you have said, right? There is an instance in Exodus 10:29 where a yes, no question in, I think this is Moses saying, he says, ken dibarta. Right? This is in Hebrew, right? Kendibarta, which is very, very close to su epas. In the Septuagint, right? The Greek translation of the Old Testament, it's erekas, which is you have said. So very close to su epas, which would be you said. But the point here is that it's all understood as an affirmation. So that's the way I read this text is Matthew is recording Jesus saying yes, but in a way that we wouldn't normally say so. In Mark 14 and Luke 22, so in Mark 14, Jesus begins with egoimi. And so this could be an implicit reference to, so egoimi would be I am. Okay. So first of all, this could just be an answer to the question. Okay. That's on the table. Are you the Christ? I am. Again, that's perfectly normal. But it is also a, could be, probably is, I would say, an allusion to Exodus 3, where God gives his name as egoimi, same two words, ho'on in Greek. That's what it would be in Greek, would be egoimi ho'on. So Jesus gives the beginning of the I am who I am saying in Greek as a response to Caiaphas's question about Jesus being the Christ or the Son of the Blessed. So if Jesus is alluding to that, it's even stronger than just su apas. It's not just an affirmation. He's connecting himself with Yahweh, right? That's what he would be doing. Luke also has this at the very end. Humes legete hoti, that is, you guys say that I am. Okay, so again, it could just be that he's affirming, you guys say that I am, and indeed I am. But the fact that there is this egoimi could be an allusion to Exodus 3 with God's name being I am who I am. Now, what is really interesting about this, this is in Matthew's version and Luke's version, is in the beginning of this quote, or just before this quote about Jesus being the Son of Man, there is this temporal phrase. In Matthew, it's ap arti, and in Luke, it's apo tu nun. So both of these mean from now on, okay? Arti is now and nun is now. They're both, and apo is in both. It just means from. So in both cases, it's from now on. And then he gives this quote. From now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Okay, that's the quote in Matthew that follows from now on. What is very odd about this is, obviously, Jesus is on trial for his life, right? And so he is saying, from now on, when? Now, when he is speaking, the Son of Man is going to be ruling. He's going to be at the right hand of power, right? And coming on the clouds of heaven. Everyone would have understood that to mean he's in charge. I mean, it's a quote of Daniel 7, where the Son of Man is, again, at the right hand of God, and he's ruling and reigning. And so Jesus seems to suggest here that from this point forward, he is reigning and ruling in a different way. From this moment on, they're going to see the Son of Man reigning. And so when you put that perspective into the Passion narrative, this is the way he rules and reigns. This is the whole point, is that he rules and reigns through his death. And it starts at Jesus's trial. So this is a huge statement, super interesting, but also shows you the kind of king and kingdom that Jesus is bringing. So with this in mind, we're going to go to the cry of dereliction. So this is Matthew 27, 46 and Mark 15, 34. It's not in Luke. The cry of dereliction means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Or that's what it's referring to. Before we get into the significance of this, I do want to take a little detour on what language was Jesus speaking. First of all, because I think it's interesting. This is the Biblical Languages Podcast. And it is indeed quite interesting. And two, it's actually quite unclear. And there's been, like everything else in scholarship, quite a lot of debate about it. And you might be curious, if you're reading your English Bible, why there are these subtle differences between Matthew's version of this and Mark's. So Matthew's version has eli lema sabachthani, okay? Mark's version has eloi lema sabachthani, okay? So the main difference, and this is just pulling from the NA28 Greek New Testament, so that's just a standard text of the Greek New Testament. We'll look at in a second that there's a lot of variation in the manuscripts. So they're also giving us an interpretation. But the main difference between these two quotes in Matthew and Mark, at least as this Greek New Testament gives us, is in this first word, eli versus eloi, eloi. And even so, even if you don't know Greek or Hebrew, you can tell that the words I'm saying sound different. Eli, eloi. So eli is in Matthew 27 and Eloi is Mark 15. Okay. So we're going to look at why these are different and try to explain the differences. The big question is this Hebrew or is it Aramaic? Okay. So that's the big question that we're asking. What is interesting, right, is that Jesus was probably often speaking Hebrew or Aramaic. I think he probably spoke Greek as well, but most of the time the words are just in Greek. So most of the time the authors don't really tell us what language he's speaking and they don't really seem to care. They're more interested in whatever meaning is represented and they just put it all in Greek. But there are a few instances where they say, hey, he said this exactly. These are the sounds that came out of his mouth kind of thing. And this is one of those instances. And so it's interesting to ask the question, what language was he speaking? So with that being said, looking at Matthew first, I have here pulled up the textual apparatus for Matthew 27 from the NA 28. So what does that mean? It means that in this Greek New Testament, they give you all of the different readings and all the different manuscripts. So there's lots of different manuscripts of the Greek New Testament, and some of them have variations. Most of them are insignificant, and some of them are more significant. Okay. So here, I'm not going to go through all of this. It looks like complete gibberish if you don't know how to read it. But just to highlight some of the variations that we see in this verse for Matthew's gospel. Again, if you think about a manuscript written in the third century, here's the idea. It had a certain configuration of Greek letters here. And if another one, a century later, had a different configuration of Greek letters, then we're left with a decision to make on which one is the original. Okay. In this case, Matthew's gospel is kind of all over the map in the manuscripts. There are many manuscripts that have Eloi, Eloi, just like in Mark's. Okay. But the NA 28, right? The people who are trying to figure out exactly what the original was are saying that that's probably not right because they have Eli, Eli in our Greek New Testament. And then there's all kinds of variations with the next two words as well. So instead of lema, they have lama or lima. And instead of sabachthani, there's zdaftani and all other kinds of variations of sabachthani, sabachthane, or e. So just different variations, okay? Mark is very similar. Some manuscripts, right? Just like some manuscripts in Matthew have Eloi, Eloi, some manuscripts from Mark have Eli, Eli. And then again, instead of lema sabachthani, we have lima sabachthani, lama zdaftani. So what's going on here? Why is there so much variation in these Greek New Testament manuscripts for this phrase? So let's look at the differences between Eli and Eloi. So Eli would map onto Hebrew. It would sound just like that. Eli, which would be my God. Eloi would map onto Aramaic, and that would be Elohi. That would be my God in Aramaic. So you can see that they're similar, but the key difference is the O that we have in Aramaic. Okay. So the question to begin with is Eli or Eloi more likely to be the thing that Jesus said? What's very interesting is that in both Matthew and Mark, they record confusion over Jesus's words. So some people think that he's calling Elijah. That is the response. And it's weird because it's like, why would he be calling Elijah? And what makes you think he is? Well, Elijah's name is Elia, which you could shorten to Eli, right? That is identical to the Hebrew Eli, what the shortened form would be. And even the longer form, Elia, is very close to Eli. Versus Eloi would be much, much harder to confuse with Elijah in Greek. To me, this suggests, so if both Matthew and Mark are recording this, this suggests that Eli is the best reading of what Jesus said. So they are confusing Eli, referring to my God, with Greek Eli, referring to Elijah. So these might be people that didn't speak Hebrew or Aramaic, or Hebrew in this case, because I'm arguing that it's Hebrew. So they might be thinking, okay, I'm a Greek speaker. Oh, I heard him just say Eli, Eli. Right? I didn't understand the rest of what he just said, but maybe he's calling Elijah, right? So they wait to see if he's calling Elijah. Obviously, nothing happens. And so this, to me, is a strong indicator that at least the first two words were probably Eli, Eli. So what does that leave us? The next word is lama. So in some manuscripts, we have lama. Some manuscripts, we have lema or lima. Lama would be Hebrew. Lama is why. Okay. Lema or lima all could be variations of how this might be put into Greek from Aramaic, but that's Aramaic. Okay. So again, these are very close in this case. Lema, lama, you know, what's the difference, right? But you can see that there's confusion within the manuscripts, right? Because if we just said we started with Hebrew, and lama would be the most natural thing to continue with because that's Hebrew. But as we will see, sabachthani, so now we come to the last word, sabachthani is Aramaic, okay? In Psalm 22, it's azaftani. That's the actual word in Psalm 22 in Hebrew. This actually is attested in some manuscripts as zdaftani, right? So this azaftani is actually, at least in some manuscripts, represented in Hebrew. So the whole thing would be in Hebrew. Eli, Eli, lama, zdaftani, okay? But most manuscripts, or at least the best manuscripts, have sabachthani, okay? Which would be shevachthani, or shevachthani, however you want to pronounce Aramaic. People do it different ways. And so this would be the Aramaic form. So here's the problem we've set up. Most likely, I would say almost certainly, Eli, Eli is the correct form in the beginning, and that's Hebrew. And then we have this middle word, Y, which is very close in both languages. And then we have sabachthani, which is almost certainly the correct word at the end. And this is in Aramaic. So we have half in Hebrew, the beginning in Hebrew, and half in Aramaic. So there would be reason, right? This middle word, for example, there would be reason to make it harmonize with either the last half of the verse or the first half of the verse. There would be reason, if I was reading Eli, Eli as Hebrew in the beginning, I might change the last verb to zdaftani instead of sabachthani to, again, harmonize with the rest of the verse. Clearly, this was a problem. The people were very confused about what was going on and what Jesus actually said. I think, though, when you look at Mishnaic Hebrew and just what was Hebrew like during the first century, it was heavily influenced by Aramaic and even Greek. There was all kinds of loanwords from Greek and Aramaic, but especially Aramaic. And so it wouldn't be crazy to say that this is just half Hebrew and half Aramaic, which is exactly what all the evidence points to. It just feels weird to us. So this could be that this actually is Hebrew, right? With this last word, sabachthani. We know that this root has already come into Hebrew as a loanword. Jesus could just be, you know, expressing this idea, which is the same idea in Hebrew as azaftani, just with the Aramaic word sabachthani. Okay. So to me, it seems like Eli is clear. That's Hebrew. That pretty much has to be the case given in the narrative, the response of the people and their connection to Eli, meaning Eli or Elijah. And then sabachthani textually just seems to be the better reading. That's probably Aramaic. So that's either Aramaicized Hebrew, which again, we know from the first century that Hebrew was being Aramaicized, right? There were all kinds of loan words coming into it from Aramaic, or it's just a mixture of the two. And again, it's just people feel like this is very weird, but when you do speak two languages and when those two languages are very close, it would be very normal to just slip in and out of one and the other. And then, you know, in the middle word can just go either way. That to me is the best reading of what Jesus actually said. It was probably this combination of Hebrew and Aramaic, or Hebrew with an Aramaicized ending, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. Okay, so that was just trying to figure out what Jesus actually said. Now that we've said that, okay, why? What's the purpose of the quote in Psalm 22? This is interesting because so some scholars have just said, well, you know, it's just him feeling really, really bad, right? And obviously, that's part of it. My God, why have you forsaken me? But another part of it has been suggested, namely that Jesus is trying to reference the whole of Psalm 22 when he quotes the first verse. So this was a known practice at the time that basically people knew their Bibles so well that when you quoted one part of a chapter, you might be referencing an extended part of it, the whole thing, or more than just that one verse. So scholars have gone back and forth whether that's true or not. What's interesting, though, is that in all of the Gospels, including John, there are multiple references to Psalm 22. And it seems like the authors are trying to say that this is a fulfillment of Psalm 22. So obviously we have what we just said, the cry of dereliction, Psalm 22:1. Jesus actually quotes the Psalm. Okay. Psalm 22:7 is quoted in Matthew 27:39 and Mark 15:29. Psalm 22:8 is in Matthew 27:43 and Luke 23:35. There's other allusions. We have Psalm 22:15, Psalm 22:17, Psalm 22:18, right? All of these verses packed in a very short little story, all these allusions to Psalm 22. So the question is, why? When you read Psalm 22:1, Jesus' cry, in the context of all these other allusions to the Psalm, my suggestion is that it is clear that the authors are wanting to say that this is Jesus fulfilling this Psalm. So the question is, what is the end of Psalm 22? How does it end? I'm just going to read this. This is just an English version. I can't even remember which one, ESV or I think NIV. This is Psalm 22, 27 through 31. So it says, all the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. For dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship. All who go down to the dust will kneel before him. Those who cannot keep themselves alive. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. Multiple things in here could refer to Jesus' death and resurrection. But at the very least, we already saw Jesus say to Caiaphas, from now on, I'm going to be reigning and ruling. And here we have at the end of Psalm 22 in verse 28, for dominion belongs to the Lord and he rules over the nations. Right after Jesus' death, Jesus commissions his disciples to go to the nations to announce the kingdom of God to them. So to me, it is not far-fetched to say when the gospel writers are continuously alluding to Psalm 22, and when Jesus himself alludes to this psalm, he doesn't intend, or they don't intend, just the parts before the end, right? Although obviously those parts are the parts that are actually happening during the crucifixion, right? They're dividing his garments, casting lots for his garments, that kind of thing. Those are the allusions to Psalm 22. But then at the end, after it's all said and done, this is the way that Jesus reigns and rules, right? This is what Jesus said. From now on, you will see me seated at the right hand of the power. The way he reigns and rules is through his death and resurrection. And if everyone had the end of Psalm 22 in mind, or if the gospel writers are suggesting that we should have the end of Psalm 22 in mind, we know that the end is with Yahweh ruling over the nations. This is him ruling over the nations. And how does he do it? He does it through his son, through his death and resurrection. So that brings us to Peter, do you love me? Okay. Again, scholars have done a lot of different things with this. And it's very interesting because the Greek is, there's just some nuances in here that are hard to bring out in a translation. And so what does it mean, right? So first of all, you know, question Peter's love three times parallels Peter's threefold denials. That's almost certainly the case. We'll just say that up front. Okay. The question is, each of these questions of Jesus has subtle differences. And is there a difference in meaning between them, particularly in degree? And I'll explain what that means. So the first question is in John 21:15. So each of these questions has Jesus asking the question first, Peter responding, and then Jesus giving a command. Okay, so that's the structure of each one. So in the first case, it's Jesus saying, agapas me pleon touton. Okay, do you love me more than these? And Peter replies, nai kyrie, sou oidas, hoti philose. Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus says, boske ta arniamu. And so this is variously translated. I'm going to say, nourish my lambs. Okay. And I'll get back to this translation in a second. But if you notice, if you know Greek, Jesus says, do you love? And Peter replies with philo. You can, even if you don't know Greek, those two words sound different. Most of the time, they're both translated as love into English. Okay. So there's two different Greek words, right? Jesus is asking one thing and Peter is just is responding with a different word. Okay, that's going to be important for us moving forward. The second question, John 21:16, Jesus says, agapas me. Okay, so if you notice the difference between this one and the first one is, agapas me pleon touton. Do you love me more than these? Okay, and so in the second question, it's just agapas me. And Peter gives an identical response. Nai kyrie sou oidas oti philose. Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And again, we have this mismatch between Jesus' word for love, agapas, and Peter's word for love, philo. And then Jesus says this command, poimaine ta probatamu. And this is like, pasture my sheep. And then we come to the third question. And here Jesus says, phileis me. Here Jesus uses the word for love that Peter has been using throughout. And here Peter gives a slightly different response. Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And here as well, there is a different word for no. There is pantasi oidas, which, so Peter has used oidas previously. He has not used ginoskes. And so he still holds to the same thing. Look, Jesus, philose, I know. This is how I feel towards you, philose. Okay. But once Jesus questions that with the same word that he's been saying, Peter gets a different response. And then Jesus finally says, bosque ta probatamu, nourish my sheep. Okay. So here again, I'm going to try to explain this. I've put up this chart for the three different questionings and follow-up responses. And I will try to explain it to anyone who is just listening. But there is this initial question, okay? What's interesting about this question and what hasn't been given enough attention is that it is a comparative, okay? Agapas me pleon touton. Do you love me more than these? Almost certainly, this is a reference to the disciples, right? These mean the disciples, that they're all there together. And so Jesus is saying, do you love me more than these guys? Now, on the face of it, that's ambiguous. Do you love me more than these guys love me? Or do you love me more than these guys, right? Meaning, is your love for me greater than for them? I think it's probably the first. Do you love me more than these guys? And Peter doesn't answer the question, right? He doesn't say, yes, Lord, you know that I love you more than them, right? He just says this simple response, nai kyrie sou oidas hoti philose. Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. So Jesus starts off with this comparison. Why? I think it is probably to suggest that Peter probably feels that he doesn't love Jesus more than them, because Peter is the one that denied Jesus. They did not, at least some of them did not. Okay. You could argue that some of them ran away and et cetera, but no one really flat out denied Jesus except for Peter. Okay. Jesus is, to begin with, he's already setting up this comparison. And one thing about comparatives is that they have to do with degrees. Okay. And so this has really been one of the central questions about this passage is Jesus moving from lower love to higher love? Right. And how does this fit in with Peter's response? I think it's very clear from Jesus's initial question that he is talking about degrees, right? Because he gives it a comparative. So he's already set up this Peter versus someone else kind of thing. So really, if you think about it, you don't even have to love someone to love them more than someone else. You could, in theory, you could not like someone at all, but you could love them still more than someone who totally despises them. So this doesn't really tell us how much Peter loves Jesus. So Jesus asked the question, right? Do you love me more than them? And so Peter's response is philose, right? The answer to Jesus' question is using the verb that Jesus will use last, okay? So when Jesus moves on to the second question, agapas me. Okay, here we have a difference because it's not comparative anymore. Do you love me? An affirmative answer to that question has to mean that you actually love him, right? Whereas if you love me more than these, doesn't have to be, you don't actually have to love the person. But here, then Peter replies with the same thing. Philose, you know that I love you, right? So if we've moved clearly, we have to have moved in degrees from the first question to the second question. And then from the second question to the third question, the assumption would be that we are, again, moving in degrees of love. The first question is the least amount of love. The second question is the middle amount of love. The third question is the most amount of love, okay? And this is where Jesus says, phileis me, do you love me? And this is the same word that Peter has been using throughout. So here's the idea. Jesus is asking three times, do you love me? Do you really love me? Do you really, really love me? Like that kind of thing. And then Peter throughout, right? He's saying, Lord, I really, really love you. I really, really love you. I really, really love you. He's giving that same response throughout the whole thing, okay? So Peter too, in question three, he's saddened by question three. Why is he saddened by question three? Because he's already said this exact thing. Yes, philose. So if this is the strongest form of love, Jesus asking that at the end is to Peter, is he saying, hey, I've been saying this, philose. I don't have, you know, even not comparing myself to others, right? You know that I love you, okay? There's another reason why I think this really is a difference in degree, again, against some scholars. Peter has no problem repeating himself verbatim, right? Literally the second and third answers to the question are the exact same. And the last one, it's the exact same verb for love. He just says, you know everything. And then he gives a different form for no, which is probably a little bit stronger as well. And he again repeats himself that he loves him in this way. And so Peter, it seems, is repeating himself that he really does love Jesus. And Jesus is confirming this with progressively higher degrees of love until at the end he says, okay, enough, right? So this is, again, debated, but that is my current position on this whole issue. The last thing is Jesus' follow-up. So what's interesting is that Jesus actually does give different commands to Peter. In the first one, it's bosque ta aniamu. And the second one, poimane ta probatamu. And in the third one is bosque ta probatamu. So here's the kind of structure. Bosque ta aniamu is, so we have ta aniamu in the first one, and that is different than the second and third, right? And then the first and third have the same verb, and the second one has a different verb, okay? So first of all, what's the difference between ta aniamu and ta probatamu? So remember, the first one has ta aniamu. This is normally lambs, okay? The second and third have ta probatamu, and that is just plain old sheep, okay? So really, just the way to think about this logically is lambs are a subset of sheep, okay? Every lamb is a sheep, but not every sheep is a lamb because lambs are baby sheep. So the first command then is to do something for the lambs, okay? Now, that brings us to the verbs. So we have two different verbs here. Philo actually makes a distinction between these two verbs. It's in that the worse is wont to attack the better. That's the reference from Philo 25, paragraph 25. So basically he says that bosco, and so this is the verb found in the first and third question, is to nourish. And poimaino is to guide or lead. Okay. So here we have nourish first, lambs. Then we have second, guide sheep, and then nourish lambs. Okay. So why does he do this? First of all, I'll say it up front. This is hard to know, right? Some people have just said, oh, these are synonyms. Look, they've used this also as an argument for there being no distinction between the love words. And they said, oh, look, he's just playing with language and he's using synonyms in the same way. Again, Peter's response is consistent, always the same. Why isn't Jesus the same? Probably because he means something different. So synonyms in the place, in the context of each other, you know, or close synonyms, right? Often draw out the subtle contrast between the two. So in this case, I would suggest that arnia, the lambs, refer to the disciples. So the reason why is because in the first question, he is comparing Peter's love to the disciples' love, right? And then he references, the idea would be that he references his immediate disciples in his follow-up, okay? So he's calling them the arniamu, the lambs. And then he gives two commands to the general probata. So this, I think, is just general Jesus' followers, like his people, right? So if the lambs are just his disciples, right? His immediate disciples that are right there, the sheep are everyone. So for the sheep, he says, to guide, lead, protect, that kind of thing in the second follow-up. In the third follow-up, he says to nourish them. Okay. Here we have these two commandments to Peter to guide, lead, and protect Jesus' followers as a whole. And then also to nourish them, right? These are should be understood spiritually, right? None of them are sheep and none of them need this sort of like nourishment, right? Like physically. So this is Peter's call to be the leader of the church. This is Peter's commission to take care of the sheep, both in terms of guiding and protecting them and nourishing them. Now, what's lacking in this is the call for Peter to lead, guide, and protect, right? This is how I'm translating poimaino, and this is exactly what Philo does with it, to lead, guide, and protect the lambs, right? So if those are the disciples, why does he say just to nourish them and not to guide and protect them? So what's interesting about this is that right after this, Jesus says that Peter will die for him, right? He describes his death. And we know that many of the disciples died very gruesome deaths. At least that's what church history, early documents have told us. And so maybe what he's saying, Jesus here, is there is this subtle hint. Okay, you need to nourish my lambs, the ones that are closest to me. And you need to protect and nourish everyone else. But the ones that are closest to me, they're going to die. And they're going to be treated harshly, right? And those ones, right, you're not going to be able to protect and guide in that way. Again, that is in keeping with one, church history of what we know about what happens to Jesus' immediate disciples, but two, keeping with the context of Jesus talking about the disciples right here, comparing Peter's love to their love, and the word arnia, referring to lambs, that would be a term of more like fondness, and then also just the actual difference between these words and the immediate context following where Jesus begins talking about the death that Peter will have for Jesus. For those reasons, I think there is actually a difference between what Jesus is saying here. Jesus uses different words and he means different things by them. And in both his questions to Peter and in his follow-up, his commands to Peter. Again, lots has been said about this. I'm just giving you some linguistic reasons to view this passage in this way. So let's just go over a few highlights of where we've been. We said Isaiah 53:7, despite there being reason to, God's servant did not open his mouth. That's the best reading, I would say, according to the grammar. Caiaphas' question, Jesus affirms that he is king. He does it with a subtle reference to Exodus 3, Yahweh, at least in Mark's gospel, possibly in Luke's as well. And he affirms that he is reigning as king, even beginning at his trial. In the cry of dereliction, which is probably originally spoken in a combination of Hebrew and Aramaic, Jesus references Psalm 22. And throughout the passion narrative, the gospel writers are referencing Psalm 22 and alluding to it in different ways that Psalm 22 is happening now. And the end of Psalm 22 speaks about his universal kingdom. And that is completely in line with what Jesus has said in that this is how he's going to reign as king, right? He begins at his trial. He is reigning and ruling. And that looks differently than the world would think. But this is the beginning, right? These references of Psalm 22 are the beginning of his ruling over the nations. And then finally, Jesus questioning Peter. Jesus uses different words for a reason. And Peter uses the same words for a reason. This is not just stylistic variation or whatever. Jesus reinstates Peter and commissions him to nourish and protect the flock while hinting at the violent death of his immediate disciples. So I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Biblical Languages podcast and diving into these sayings of Jesus from his death and resurrection. I know I had a lot of fun looking into all these various issues. I hope you did as well.
Thank you for listening to the Biblical Languages podcast brought to you by Biblingo. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app and leave us a review. You can also follow Biblingo on social media to discuss the episode with us and other listeners. And don't forget to visit biblingo.org to start your 10-day free trial of Biblingo.